Bill Cachetis joins us on Sports Byline. He's an author, and his latest book is called Macho Row, the 1993 Phillies and Baseball's Unwritten Code. Bill, you've written another book about the Phillies. It was the 1980 World Series championship team. What's your fascination with the Phillies?
I've been a Phillies fan ever since the age of six, and my first year following the team was a very infamous one, 1964, when the Phillies had a 6.5-game lead with 12 left to play, and they dropped 10 straight to finish second, blowing the pennant. So it was a rather infamous start to my love of baseball, but that 80 team was the team I really, really grew up with. And the 93 team was really a special one to me because there's all people who love baseball. I'm sure at one time or another they wish that they were major league players, and those guys would have been my contemporaries. Had I fulfilled my dream and played for the Phillies, I would have been on that team.
You know, Bill, that losing at the very end of the season, I always felt that that kind of shaded the fans and the way they look upon the Phillies. Am I correct in that observation?
Yes and no. One would expect that, you know, when you get that close to winning a World Series, just to lose, you know, on a home run in the bottom of the ninth inning with an out in game six, that it would. And one would also expect that Mitch Williams, our closer who threw that home run ball, would be persona non grata in Philadelphia. But it just didn't work out that way. In fact, Williams is close to being beloved in Philadelphia because he had the guts to admit that he blew it. And he didn't shy away from anybody in the locker room afterwards. But that team also was really a blue-collar Philadelphia team. They pulled no punches. There was no pretense on that team. They were a group of hard-working, blue-collar guys, and even more important, they were accessible to the fans. You could go into a local bar after a game and run into these guys. They bought the fans drinks. Fans bought them drinks, sometimes dinner. They really love Philadelphians, and we felt it. So to this day, I do believe that they are, in terms of baseball, the most beloved team that the city has ever had.
And the Phillies in the book, you describe them as colorful, shaggy, misfits, and outlaws who played hard and partied hard. And I was thinking about the fact that in baseball at that particular time, almost every team was like that, weren't they?
No, absolutely not. If you remember, the 1990s were a time period where the multimillion dollars were flowing fast and furious, and a lot of these players, a lot of major league players, did not want to risk injury. Particularly the teams that the Phillies played against in the postseason, the Atlanta Braves and Toronto, those teams were loaded with multimillionaire athletes. And, you know, they had a lot of talent, but they refused to leave it out on the field. And they were prima donnas. Both of those teams were. And the Phillies had one of the lower salaried scales in the major leagues. They were guys who were just hanging on for dear life a couple years before to stay in the major leagues. And that's why the fans could relate with them. They really played by the code of baseball, you know, which basically said you have your teammates back, you leave it on the field, you play when you're hurt, and you keep your mouth shut when you hear or see something in the clubhouse.
I'll tell you, when I take a look at that team, Darren Dalton, John Kruk, Lenny Dykstra, and Mitch Williams, which you all talk about in the book here, but they really had the right band leader, did they not, in manager Jim Fregosi? I knew Jim when he was alive, and when I think back after reading parts of this book and everything, I thought, just the perfect manager.
He was. Fregosi was the perfect manager for that team. He was a veterans manager, not one of these guys who's going to go disciplining the players. He could make a lineup. He used his platoon system really well on that team, and he let the players police themselves. And I really should add that Fregosi the combination of Fregosi and Darren Dalton, who was the lead dog, really the unofficial captain of that team. It was that combination that made that team so successful, because Dalton was the guy who had been there the longest. He was one of only four guys who had come up through the, you know, the Phillies system. He knew the town. He knew the sports writers. He knew how to educate all these other guys who had come into the organization. And he was one of those blue-collar players. So what he said went. And the combination of the two of those guys, Fregosi and Dalton, that was the key to the success of that season.
Two quotes from your book, one by Darren Dalton. Fregosi and I could relate to each other, whether we were in the clubhouse or on the field. In 1993, the city of brotherly love changed the world. Fregosi was the driving force. And John Kruk, always a free spirit, said Jimmy was the perfect manager for our team. He knew exactly when to leave us alone and exactly when to jump on our asses when it was needed. Along the way, he became our friend. When you go through that going to the World Series season in 1993, what were the key moments?
Well, the key moment, if we talk about the World Series, not getting there, because there were a bunch of key moments in that NLCS, but the key moments for the Phillies in that series were game number two that Terry Mulholland won in Philadelphia, 6-4. The Jays won the first game, and Philly really needed that. They needed to win that game, too. And Mulholland came through. He beat Dave Stewart 6-4. The turning point in the series, unfortunately for the Phillies, was game four. The Jays and the Phillies were playing in a rainy, crummy game in Philadelphia. There were a couple rain delays. They traded leads. Dykstra, I believe, had two home runs in that game. In the second one, he willed it out of the ballpark. He knew, I think he hit it in the seventh inning, they were down. And he even said to the guys on the bench, I'm putting us ahead. You know, that's it. And he went out and he hit a home run, which he was known to do. He did it for the Mets in 86. But the Phillies lost that game 15-14, and that broke their backs. They won the next day 2-0 under Schilling, but it didn't matter, because by that time it was a fait accompli. The series was going back to Toronto, and they lost. They were clinging to a 6-5 lead in the bottom of the ninth inning. Joe Carter comes up with two guys on, you know, hits a 2-2 fastball, clinches the game and the series. And that really, I one thing about Philadelphia, and I'm sure it's true of many other major league cities, but we really do live and die with our teams. And there was just a pall over the city that next day. I mean, we really felt as if this had been stolen from us. We felt like Dykstra said, you know, this was to be. It was our series, you know, and it just, the Cinderella story just didn't finish the way we wanted it to. And Philadelphians really hurt. They really hurt because we are. I mean, back then we were a football town primarily because of the Eagles, but the Phillies had such a colorful bunch of guys, and they were so close to the fans that, you know, everybody was a Phillies fan in 1993. Everybody, even the football fans, were Phillies fans.
We only have about a little over a minute left, but you do touch on it in the book. The 90s, of course, was the steroid era, the beginning of it, and you talk about the alleged steroid use on the team.
Well, clearly, you know, this book, I could have had this book published easily 10 years before it was. But I think a lot of us knew that the circumstantial evidence around juicing and that team and their loyalty to the unwritten code of baseball would prevent anybody from saying anything. So when the Mitchell report came out in 2007, I said, okay, I got it. You know, I mean, Dykstra would admit it. There are a bunch of other guys who had been suspected on that team, and it was pretty clear if you look at their stats that, you know, those were far and away the biggest career years for those guys, and the circumstantial evidence is damning. So in my estimation, the 89 Oakland A's were the first steroids team, you know, to go all the way, and the 1993 Phillies were really the second, although they didn't go all the way.
In about 20 seconds, are you happy with the way this book came out, Bill?
I don't know yet. I'm never happy, frankly, until I see, until I read the reviews and see what other people say. I know I shouldn't be that way, but, you know, I put it all out there on the line the way I see it, and, you know, I just hope I get a fair shake.
Yeah, and also when your royalty checks come in, right?
Oh, absolutely, although, you know, university presses don't pay all that much, but, yeah, that's a good that's a good affirmation.
Bill, I want to thank you very much. Congratulations on the book. We're going to make it a selection of the month on the Sports Byline Book Corner. Come back when your next book comes out. Thank you, my friend.
Thank you so much.
Bill Cachetas with us. And again, check out this book. It's a great read. It's called Macho Row, the 1993 Phillies and Baseball's Unwritten Code. We continue on Sports Byline.